We've already eliminated a devastating anti-coal regulation, but that was just the beginning. Today, I'm taking bold action to follow through on that promise. My administration is putting an end to the war on coal. With today's executive action, I am taking historic steps to lift the restrictions on American energy, to reverse government intrusion, and to cancel job-killing regulations.
British Prime Minister Theresa May at last firing the starting gun in the Brexit battle on Wednesday, sending Brussels a letter launching the UK's withdrawal from the European Union under Article 50. Since Britons voted for Brexit in a referendum last June, the scale of the challenge and the UK's demands have steadily become clear. Both the so-called hard Brexit and the best possible deal in May's sights. One early obstacle to having it all, an exit bill that could run to tens of billions of euros.
I expect the first stumbling block will be how much Britain owes to the EU. And this could be incredibly sticky for Theresa May, because she has to keep her backbenchers on board. And some of them are very virulent in their assertion that Britain should pay nothing.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Wednesday. It's March 29th, 2017, 5:11 in the morning. Glad to have you along for another edition of The Opening Bell, another business day here on WGN and the Associated Bank market desk. Numbers first is what we're going to look at after the triggering of Article 50. The Brexit is officially underway. Global stocks are generally higher today. European shares rose following Wall Street's late surge yesterday. Sterling was the biggest loser on major currency markets ahead of the formal triggering of Brexit. Prime Minister Theresa May notifying the EU in a letter that Britain is quitting the bloc that it joined in 1973. It'll take a couple of years to unwind all of this. Lots of process ahead as European Union bids farewell to the United Kingdom. Other stocks we're watching this morning. Dow futures are weak this morning, looking for a lower open on Wall Street. Right now off about 8 points. The NASDAQ and S&P futures are mixed. The other European markets generally mixed this morning. The DAX and CAC are higher. The FTSE in London is off just a little bit. Asian markets are generally higher today with the Nikkei and the Hang Seng leading the way this morning in trading. It's about to end in Asia this morning. Does Chicago pay a price for segregation? There's a new study out by the Metropolitan Planning Council and the Urban Institute that tries to answer that question, and it appears that the answer is yes. Let's welcome in Alden Laurie, Director of Research and Evaluation at the Metropolitan Planning Council. Alden, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Steve, thanks for having me. It's good to be with you.
It's good to have you on. So what is the headline from the study that you folks released yesterday?
The headline essentially is that based on the research, we believe that segregation, economic segregation, racial segregation is costing the Chicago region lives, income, and potential. And it's based on a broad and sweeping analysis done by the Urban Institute on behalf of the Metropolitan Planning Council, where they compared, or I should say they analyzed, economic segregation and racial segregation in two ways, segregation between African-Americans and whites, segregation between Latinos and whites. And they did a regression analysis with those three factors against four quality of life factors: income, life expectancy, educational attainment in the form of bachelor's degrees, and homicides. And they found statistically significant links between segregation and income, particularly income of African-Americans. They also found links between segregation and homicides and between segregation and the bachelor's degree attainment for whites and African-Americans. And so we've extrapolated those numbers for the Chicago region and determined that the level of segregation in Chicago, in the Chicago region, is costing the region $4.4 billion in black income, a 30% reduction in homicides, and 83,000 bachelor's degrees, 78% of which would be attained by whites and the remaining by African-Americans. And so we think that there's an economic cost on all three of those factors, and we talk about that more in the companion report that the Metropolitan Planning Council released. The Urban Institute's report really delves into the national numbers because, you know, Chicago is a focus, but they provided these numbers from across the nation. And so you can see where each region of the 100 largest regions in the nation, where they lie on those three segregation factors. And then they posit some things and some thoughts about what this means going forward. So there's a lot of questions about, are you saying that segregation causes these things? And so we're not saying that. What we're saying, though, is that there is a strong enough relationship to believe very strongly that that these factors are influencing these quality of life indicators, and that if you are trying to address issues with regard to income or education or safety, that segregation or desegregation, lowering the level of racial and economic segregation, should be a part of whatever remedy you're coming up with.
Alden, hang on with us. We're going to get into some more of this as we continue our pre-dawn conversation. Alden Laurie, Director of Research and Evaluation at the Metropolitan Planning Council, on this new study, Does Chicago Pay a Price for Segregation?
From ABC News, Wall Street Now. Investors saw some daylight on Tuesday and posted a 150-point gain for the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It stood at 20,701 at the close. The S&P 500 rose 17 points. The NASDAQ composite was up 35. Wells Fargo will pay $110 million to settle a lawsuit by customers challenging the opening of accounts without their permission. The practice led to a scandal that cost the bank's chief executive officer his job. The deal could also end 11 other class action lawsuits. Ford Motor Company is investing $1 billion in three Michigan facilities. $200 million of that will be spent on a data center to store information collected from self-driving and connected cars. You're feeling better about your spending power, at least statistically. The Conference Board says consumer confidence has risen to its highest level in more than 16 years. The index measures consumers' view of current conditions and their expectations for the future. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. 521. We're on with Alden Laurie today, Director of Research and Evaluation at the Metropolitan Planning Council, a new report on segregation and economic costs. And Alden, before the break, you sort of give us the headline of what was happening here. Let's get a sense, before we go any further, of the ranking of segregation. This report sort of ranked Chicago among the big major cities. Where did we fall?
And just to be clear, it's the Chicago region that we were measuring among the 100 largest regions or metro areas in the nation. The Chicago region ranked ninth in terms of its level of Latino-white segregation, 10th in terms of its Black-white segregation, and 20th in terms of its economic segregation. And those segregation measures essentially are looking at the clustering of particular income groups of people or particular racial or ethnic groups of people. And so the values are stronger when there are larger sections of groups of particular people or particular incomes. And so one of the characteristics of Chicago, if you think about this in particular in the city, but to some degree also in the suburbs, when you drive through certain sections of the city, let's say you were to take the red line or you're to drive down Western Avenue, there are going to be certain sections of the city where for a long period of time you will be in a predominantly African-American area, a predominantly Latino area, or a predominantly white area. And so there are other places like a Houston or an Atlanta that may have a similar racial mix as a region, but those enclaves, if you will, are not as densely packed and they aren't as large geographically as you find in Chicago.
This report should open the eyes of many. Is there a call to action here? And how can communities like Chicago and areas like Chicago solve this problem going forward?
We certainly see this report as a call to action. And essentially, when one section of the companion report that NPC released, we talk about how there has actually been incremental change on all three of those levels of segregation in the Chicago region from 1990 to 2000 and from 2000 to 2010. And in fact, the Chicago region was the only region in the nation of those 100 metros that saw declines in each of those three measurements in each of those decades. But the movement is too slow. And we've only declined maybe about 10 or 11% in all three of those metrics over that 20-year span. And in order for us to get down to the median, which is essentially the level where we say we kind of hypothesize is the level we would like to be at, it's going to take 50 to 60 years for some of those metrics, particularly in terms of the black-white metrics. So what we're saying is that we're seeing improvement, but the improvement is just too slow. And so this is a call to action for us to see what the costs have been and what they will continue to be unless we can do something that kind of speeds things up. And so and in phase two of this work, what the Metropolitan Planning Council is doing is reaching out and connecting with as many stakeholders and experts in seven different policy areas: housing, economic development, transportation, just to name a few, and really sitting down and talking with folks about what they are seeing on the ground, how do they believe segregation impacts their work, impacts the issues, and then talking with them about remedies, potential solutions, things that they've seen work for themselves, that they've seen work in other places around the country. So that's one thing that we're doing. The other thing is we're turning back to the numbers, and we're trying to take a closer look, particularly at some examples. Atlanta is one example that we really want to take a closer look at. They saw their level of black-white segregation fall from 21st ranked in 1990 to 30th in 2000 and then to 41st in 2010. And their measurement of black-white segregation in 2010 was 40% lower than it was in 1990. So something is happening in the Atlanta metro area. We want to dig in closer and take a look and hopefully pull some lessons from that.
Yeah, so there's a good optimism there that there are solutions to this. At least they're happening. And, you know, the other thing, too, that sort of kind of turns everything on its head is this notion that it's not the communities that are being segregated that pays the price here. It's really all of us in a community.
Yeah, right. I mean, even with the finding of additional African-American income, when income of any level increases in a region, you know, it has a ripple effect on the economy. And so if we were to add $4.4 billion in income to the Chicago region, we're suggesting that we'd see an $8 billion boost to the region's GDP. The other issue is homicides. The relationships that we're seeing between homicides and segregation is not just affecting areas that we, you know, usually often think of when we think about violence. So that's a region-wide benefit in terms of a reduction in homicides. And that's a region-wide benefit economically as well, because the homicide narrative that has kind of fallen upon Chicago is not just affecting the communities that we think about most often when we think about homicides. It's affecting the entire region, you know, in terms of thinking about how attractive a place Chicago is. If there are news stories about the violence happening in Chicago, even if it's happening mostly in certain areas of Chicago, it still has an economic benefit or economic detriment to the region as a whole. And of course, if we have fewer people earning bachelor's degrees, and those are bachelor's degrees that would mostly be attained by whites, which is a very interesting part of that finding, because I don't think intuitively that's something that people think about when they think about segregation. That's certainly a benefit or a detriment that is happening across the region to different groups, and has an economic component to it as well. If you're not earning the bachelor's degree, if you're earning something less than that, you're earning less lifetime over your lifetime to the tune of $90 billion is what we put out in our study. And, of course, that is going to have an economic cost for the entire region as a result.
Alden, we have about a minute and a half left, but I want to ask you this $8 billion figure of GDP. What kinds of things could that do positively for a community? You talked about reversing maybe the homicide rate, but what are we talking about? Better schools, better living conditions generally?
Well, you know, the GDP is, you know, measurement of goods and services and generally an indicator of economic health. And so I think, you know, there are a lot of things that would kind of go into that. But in certain parts of the region, there are, you know, the more depressed areas. You know, that kind of economic growth leads to greater vitality. And that makes, you know, the region a more attractive place, even in the smaller geographic level. Places that are, you know, would be hard pressed to find commerce or to attract other kinds of investment. You know, the vacant lots would start disappearing, the rundown buildings would start disappearing, and we'd see more kind of vitality in certain parts of the region. And ultimately, that would be a benefit, I think, to the region as a whole as well.
Alden Laurie, the director of research and evaluation at the Metropolitan Planning Council. Alden, thanks for being with us on the Opening Bell this morning.
Steve, thanks for having me.
From ABC News, Tech Trends, putting more focus on your photos and videos. Facebook is doing a worldwide rollout of three new features for its main app. The first is a camera that will appear to the left of your newsfeed. Facebook product manager Connor Hayes says a lot of effort went into choosing all of the new effects and filters it'll offer.
We went on the ground, did a lot of research to understand what people in those countries and cultures really enjoyed talking about, and gave them tools to be very communicative within their own sort of context.
Next, a stories feature, like the one seen in other Facebook-owned apps, including Instagram and WhatsApp.
Which is a new lightweight mode for people to share photos and videos with one another that sits on top of your newsfeed.
And finally, something called Direct.
Which is a private sharing space for photos and videos that you really just want to send with one person or a few.
Anyone using the latest version of the Facebook app should have access to all of these features immediately. With Tech Trends, I'm Daria Alvinger, ABC News.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. Glad to have you along here on our Wednesday edition of The Opening Bell 540. It is a sponge that can soak up oil in water. And it's something that scientists have invented at the Argonne National Lab outside of Chicago. It is a game changer that could not only save money, the environment, and oil, but something that could be used in all kinds of different applications. We're happy to have with us one of the lead scientists that worked on this, Seth Darling from Argonne, this morning. Seth, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell. This is a big deal. This is called a oil-soaking sponge. Is that the official name of it?
Oleo sponge is what we're calling it, yeah. So this is basically a reusable oil adsorbent. The idea is to try and address oil spills in bodies of water. The way that people deal with that today is with things like burning it or trying to skim it off the surface, and those either don't work or they have their own environmental consequences, like with burning. The idea here is that we have this sponge which can selectively soak up oil without grabbing the water, and then you can squeeze it and recover that oil, and then go back and reuse the sponge over and over and over again.
What is it about this cloth or this fabric that makes it do this?
So it's really like a sponge. It feels like a kitchen sponge or like a cushion. In fact, our starting material for this is just a foam, like polyurethane foam, which is exactly what you're sitting on if you're on a chair right now. But that foam as it stands doesn't do this. It doesn't soak up oil and not water. And so what we do is we play with the chemistry that is on the surface of all the fibers that make up that foam, and we give them that property so that they are what's called oleophilic, meaning they love oil and they're hydrophobic. They hate water.
This almost sounds like something space age, and you know, people always give that phrase that they describe things that way. But what is it that led you to this? How did you find out that this would work?
Well, the origins of this actually go back a few years. So some colleagues of mine and I, probably about 7 years ago here at Argonne, came up with kind of a basic science discovery. We call it sequential infiltration synthesis, which is kind of a mouthful. So we call it SIS for short. And really that was just, it's a new way to make materials. It's a way to penetrate polymers with inorganic stuff like metal oxides. And at the time, we didn't have any particular application in mind. It was just a new way to make stuff. And over those years since then, we've come up with a number of arenas in which this SIS technology is potentially useful. And it was probably about 2 years ago that we just had this idea of, well, maybe we can use it to make a sponge that soaks up oil. And not knowing at all if it was going to work, but a little glimmer that it might. And, you know, we tried it out and a few stumbling blocks along the way, but the darn thing works real well.
Now, I can imagine what people are asking is I've seen the video of this working sort of in a small scale setting, but what happens when there's a big oil spill over miles and miles of lake? Will this be just as effective?
Yeah, so we've explored this in kind of several phases of research. In the first phase, we were just working on little tiny, you know, 1-inch cubes of foam to kind of demonstrate the proof of principle. But then in the next phase, we actually did a 10,000 times scale up to build kind of an 8-foot by 8-foot wall of this stuff, which we used, in fact, not only to clean up oil off the surface of the water, but we addressed a problem that, as far as I know, there is no other solution for, which is cleaning up oil below the surface of the water, like a dispersed cloud of oil droplets. And so we already did this 10,000 times scale up to do that demonstration. It's not that big a leap from there to, you know, sort of a real manufacturing commercial type scale, although that's not the kind of thing we would do here at Argonne. That's something that a commercial partner would have to take on. But one of the important points here is that because this sponge is reusable, you can soak up oil, squeeze it out, and go back and reuse it over and over and over again, you don't need to scale the amount of your sponge to the size of the spill, because it's just over and over and over again, you're reusing it. So you need a lot less of your sorbent material than the total volume of the spill.
I don't want to put words into your mouth, but this almost sounds like an amazing breakthrough that might make us rethink all oil spills in the future. This has not been able to be done before. Tell me what the future holds for this then.
Well, we're excited, of course. The team that worked on this is sort of basic scientists by training. So a lot of the work we do doesn't have such a short path from what, you know, where we leave off to where it can have a direct impact out there in the real world. So, you know, we're excited. It's just fun to work on something that has, you know, pretty clear application in the pretty near future. And, you know, I grew up with the things like the Exxon Valdez, and of course everyone remembers Deepwater Horizon, and there's countless other examples of these things, and you see the devastation that they wreak on the environment and on the economy. And so the fact that we could actually, you know, do something about that is just fun.
And the most exciting part of this is it's something that you could reuse over and over again. It almost reminds me of a Bounty towel commercial, watching this, where you kind of soak it up and squeeze it out, and it doesn't hurt anything, including the animals that might be affected by this.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this really just benefits everyone, including even the company, owning that oil, because you recover the oil in this process too. So traditional things that soaked up oil are single use. And so they soak up the oil, and what you had to do with them then typically is incinerate them, burn them. And so you have a lot of it and you're burning it. So there's an enormous amount of, you know, air pollution and so on that happens. Here, you're just reusing it, so you don't need a lot of it. You're recovering the oil, which you can extract value from because it's oil. And then you're also reusing the sorbent over and over again. So there is no waste in that process.
For those people who are thinking about how all of these disasters that you mentioned in the past and other oil spills that they've seen, how does this work in terms of deploying it? Is it something that has to be done quickly, or can it be done at any point after the oil spill is noticed?
Yeah, so oil can stick around for a long time after there's been a spill. If I'm not mistaken, there's actually still products from the Exxon Valdez sitting underneath the water on the seafloor. So it's not like this stuff disappears quickly necessarily. What we envision, though, down the line is that this oleo sponge and materials like it will be warehoused in places where spills happen. So in coastal regions, on rigs themselves, you know, in harbors and ports, places like that where diesel fuel and oil and other things end up in the water, you know, not so uncommonly. And if it's right there, it's easy to be deployed quickly, because the sooner you can get there, the less damage that's going to happen to the environment.
You mentioned that this is something that oil companies could recover the oil that's spilled. Is that who this is eventually going to pick up this and take the ball forward? Is perhaps an oil company or somebody like that? Or do you see this, the response people that respond to these things taking the ball further?
You know, I hope it's all the above. It's a great question. We've done this research on the technology, kind of getting it out there, and now we're trying to tell the world about it. And a lot of folks have been coming to Argonne, coming in the sense of, you know, calling and sending an email inquiries and so on, because some interest has been sparked. And that runs the gamut from, you know, big companies that maybe are in that oil and gas space all the way to manufacturers and small startups too. It's generated a lot of interest, and it's not clear yet, you know, which of those is really going to spark and take off, but we're confident and excited that somebody will bite.
People will ask, you know, what's the cost of the production of this going to be? Is this an expensive technology?
It's actually surprisingly low cost, we believe. So the starting material is just polyurethane foam. That is manufactured at a massive scale, millions and millions of tons every year, because it's used for so many things already. It costs next to nothing. And then we do our two-step process to it to turn it into this oleo sponge. And those steps, of course, cost something, but they're not exorbitantly expensive. And so, you know, it costs more than just plain old polyurethane foam, but not a whole lot more. And the fact that it can be reused amplifies that value, you know, many times over.
What about the animals and wildlife that we often see affected by this? Is this something that could be used to soak oil off of them?
You know, Don dish soap seems to do a pretty good job of cleaning off the animals, and I don't want to step on Don's toes. Maybe, yeah, you know, and there are actually other other applications one can imagine where there is oil somewhere where you don't want it to be, not just on an animal or on the surface of the water or under the surface of the water, but other places too. And this sponge just loves to soak up oil. And so one can imagine other arenas as well where it could see some use.
Well, as you say that, my mind just immediately went to the kitchen, where if I knock over a bottle of olive oil, that's going to be a hard cleanup. Is this something that might be on the consumer level? Is that one of the possibilities, or what were you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's within the realm of possibilities. You know, again, we're not a company, so we're not out there selling stuff. It's up to the commercial market to decide, you know, where they can make a buck. Our job is to develop and understand the science and the technology.
So Seth, what would be the next step here then? You said people are interested in talking. How would this move along?
There are various avenues here. So one is that hopefully one of these, you know, commercial folks who have reached out to Argonne will partner with us and, you know, maybe license the technology and start manufacturing it and turning it into a product that gets out there in the real world. That'll be fantastic. We'd love to see that. Another avenue is kind of cooperative research to further develop the technology, make it even better. And we can do that also with, you know, potentially with commercial partners. And then there's also just back on the research side, we have ideas on how to take this as kind of a platform technology and design it to address other problems completely different from oil and water separation. There's all kinds of things that end up in water that you don't want to be there. And we believe that we can tailor this sponge to target some other things too.
Well, this sounds like a real good argument for continued scientific research funding, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, we think so. We think there's all kinds of really interesting science and also impactful science and technology that can come out of this kind of work.
Seth, thank you very much. We appreciate you taking some time out.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Seth Darling is a nanoscientist at the Center for Nanoscale Materials at Argonne National Lab in Lamont. You can find more information at ANL.gov. And you can follow Argonne on Twitter at Argonne, A-R-G-O-N-N-E.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the program. It's 5:56 on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning. We're looking for a lower open on Wall Street. Dow futures now off about 20 points. S&P futures are lower as well. So are the NASDAQ futures. Crude oil is at $48.54 a barrel. Gold and silver are trading lower this morning. Now on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook this morning, just one big report due out today. The National Association of Realtors releases pending home sales for February. A couple of other things happening today. The latest Best States to Retire report is out. According to Bankrate.com, New Hampshire is the best state to retire, followed by Colorado, Maine, Iowa, and Minnesota. That study being released throughout the day. The U.S. Supreme Court holds hearings today in a case that features forfeiture of reasonably foreseeable proceeds of a drug conspiracy. Will be watched by courts all across the country. A new article coming out today, too, by the Journal of the American Medical Association and Psychiatry, talks about heroin use. We'll be following that later on today. The FBI Director James Comey is going to speak at the Intelligence and National Security Alliance leadership later in the day. And today, a Jackie Kennedy letter goes up for auction. This letter could fetch as much as $1 million. The letter, several of them, covers a period from when Mrs. Kennedy was first lady to her marriage to Aristotle Onassis.